SiriusXM presents Stanford Pathfinders.
Stanford has 225,000 alumni living all over the globe in 151 countries, and they're some of the most amazing people you would ever want to meet.
A show about how the graduates of Stanford University are changing our lives and the world.
We'll hear very interesting things from business leaders in the technology sector, but well beyond that, the worlds of politics, entertainment, business, and beyond.
Inspiring stories from America's innovation heartland.
It's a place where people look to the future, not to the past, where they don't rest on their laurels. Think about the gold rush. Think about Stanford being formed in the late 1800s. And then Stanford was the beginning of Silicon Valley. And the ethos of Silicon Valley is deeply embedded in the Stanford spirit. It's a spirit of innovation, experimentation. It's a spirit of being willing to try new things and risk failure as long as you fail forward.
Welcome to Stanford Pathfinders.
Author of Radical Business, How to Transform Your Organization in the Age of Global Crisis.
How can businesses worldwide, not just in the U.S., but worldwide, become a consistent force for good?
Chair of Brand New View, a global leadership development organization transformation firm.
Much of the work I've done over the past 20 years with leaders and organizations is around that idea of how leaders shape culture and how they can encourage a rich culture internally.
This week on Stanford Pathfinders, John Davis. Now, here's your host, Howard Wolf.
A million years ago, when I went to business school for my MBA, I learned something that was indelibly imprinted on my brain and has been ever since. Quite simply, the purpose of corporations was to maximize shareholder value. Three words: maximize shareholder value, full stop. Times, however, have changed. Although corporations still need to worry about the maximization of shareholder value, many believe that this is only a part of what they need to provide. These folks, academics and business leaders alike, think that corporations need to worry about a host of other things, including their impact on society. Today's guest on Stanford Pathfinders, John Davis, is the author of Radical Business. Radical Business is a new book and has a very simple thesis that fundamentally questions what I learned in business school. It questions why corporations exist. And it does so with elegant precision in a wonderfully persuasive manner. Anyone who cares about business or cares about how we best solve the biggest problems society faces will enjoy this book. I certainly did. John, welcome to the show.
Hi, Howard. Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
All right, so let's start with your background. Who are you?
My parents ask me that all the time. So there are kind of two halves of my background. If you look at professionally, I've spent pretty much half of my career in the business world and the other half in academia. And so the first half was kind of all in business, and I was in big companies. I started a couple of companies, had a blast doing that. And then many years into it, I found myself actually giving a talk at the University of Washington. And the next thing I know, I kind of got invited to teach. And that led me into this path of academia, which actually led me overseas. I moved to Singapore and with my family and taught for many years at universities over there. And so it was really kind of a wild ride. And it has been a wild ride. And within that stuff, I guess if you had to look at a common theme, the common theme has been marketing. But that's really almost a side theme now, because what I learned throughout all of that is much of what I've done throughout my life has been working with people, and marketing just happened to be the discipline to do it in. But yeah, it's been both business and academia.
So everyone who is a guest on Stanford Pathfinders must by definition be a Stanford alum, but you're a very special case of a Stanford alum because you appear to have some Stanford connections that go beyond the normal run-of-the-mill alum. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, no, thanks for that. It's true. It's rather intimidating for me, and always has been, but it's kind of fun to think about it in retrospect. So, you know, my dad was a professor at the business school where your daughter went, and he taught there for many, many years. He was a professor of marketing, passed away back in 1995, but, you know, was there for a very long time, and I got to know a lot of the business school faculty in that era and all the wonderful things, even sat in on some classes, which was an absolute gas when I was a kid watching my dad do that. My oldest brother, Steve, graduated from Stanford a few years before me. He actually was on the track team with Peyton Jordan when Peyton Jordan was a track coach. And so Steve did discus and shot put and things like that. And then he got his PhD at Stanford and ended up teaching for many years at the School of Education. Howard, it just goes on. I've got a nephew who graduated in 2007. I have a granduncle, I guess you could say, who in the turn of the century, the turn of the 20th century, got his master's degree there. I have grandparents who both went to Stanford, got their undergraduate and PhDs, again, turn of the century. And so it is kind of a crazy connection with all these different people. I do have another older brother, so there's three of us, and his name is Peter. That doesn't really mean anything other than the fact he actually got into Stanford and chose not to go. So we don't talk about Peter much.
Well, you certainly have Stanford credentials. Oh, my Lord. But the other credential you have is that before writing the book that I want to talk to you about today, Radical Business, you wrote 11 other books. Okay, so you are truly an academic at heart, but also a business guy. So you meld your academia and your business world together. So you've written 11 books. Why write this one, Radical Business? What was the catalyst for yet another book? What made this book special?
It's a burning issue has been for a number of years for me. So this is actually the 11th book. And what provided the catalyst is over particularly the last 20 years, as I mentioned, the sort of the second half of my career has been in academia. And I've been fortunate to have done a lot of executive education and teaching in programs overseas. And that led me to 40 different countries and meeting with lots of different organizations. And almost throughout those sessions and meetings with different people, and it's been such a treasure trove of wonderful experiences, I consistently kind of came up against, what is it businesses are doing that go beyond what we see every day, the making of things, widgets or whatever it might be, or the not the manufacturing, but the creation of services that we all avail ourselves of. There's got to be something else out there. And it led me to think about, well, given these experiences with these companies and trying to understand what business is really all about, it led me to think about, well, there's got to be something more at stake here. And that created the impetus for Radical Business.
So what is the thesis of the book?
The thesis is crystal clear. How can businesses worldwide, not just in the U.S., but worldwide, become a consistent force for good? Now, it sounds like hyperbole and it's not intended to. It's simply a matter of saying what businesses do right now and have done for the past century has created a lot of economic value. But the reality of it is that economic value has come at a cost. And because of the organizations I've worked with and the work that they do, those traditional measures of business value, like profit maximization, shareholder wealth creation and whatnot, are wonderful measures, but they're not sufficient given what's going on today in the world. I mean, if you think about the worldwide set of challenges we all undertake right now, whether it's currently the pandemic, which hopefully is subsiding a bit, but certainly the climate crisis, we've got social and economic injustice, food insecurity, you name it. There's an issue somewhere in the world. And business has a responsibility, I think, to step up and do more than what it has done for the past century. Not that what it has done hasn't been good, it's just no longer sufficient. And that really kind of led me to the thinking for the book. And that's sort of the primary thesis, is how do businesses become a force for good? I'll mention one other thing in there too, Howard. When you look at businesses worldwide, whether it's Jakarta or Tokyo or the US, they all operate fundamentally under some pretty basic principles, right? How do we make money? How do we ensure the survival of the business to the next day? How do we ensure our shareholders are happy? All right, that's the current sort of model.
So I was not fortunate enough to be accepted to the Graduate School of Business at Stanford. They broke my heart. But I did go to another business school during the middle of the 1980s, and it worked out well for me. I met my wife there. All is good. But if I remember one thing from my 2 years in business school back in Boston, it would be this, that companies, corporations exist to maximize shareholder value, full stop, right there. That's it. That's what we were taught in the 80s and the 90s, I would guess in the aughts. So are business schools teaching something different this day? Are leaders of corporations thinking differently about these days? Is it no longer only about maximizing shareholder value? Is that your premise here?
Yes, that's the premise to the tail end of what you said. And by the way, I didn't go to Stanford Business School either. I went to another East Coast business school in New York. And I did it partly because the family connections, I had to get away and do something on the East Coast. And when I became a business school practical professor, a professor of practice, what I taught were a lot of the same models you and I enjoyed in business school. And it became something that students everywhere have learned. And we all learned the capital asset pricing model, return on investment, and so on. And of course, profit maximization and shareholder wealth creation. And those are certainly still important measures. They're just not the only measures today. And business schools are increasingly shifting more toward a broader definition. I mean, Michael Porter has talked about shared value. I call it the societal value motive, but the premise is the same. And that is there's more at stake now, given what's going on in the world, those crises that I mentioned before, where business has to step up and determine how it's going to use its profits, if you will, toward that force for good that benefits society and not just shareholders, you know, a broader group of stakeholders, if you will. And that's partly because those stakeholders are far more actively engaged and involved now than they ever were when you and I went to grad school. And so it's definitely a different world. And much of that world is far ahead of where many businesses are. I mean, our consumers now, particularly those, if you look at surveys worldwide, under the age of 45 in particular, are pretty sensitive to what companies are doing. Are they serving a purpose that's beyond making money? Are they actually doing things that benefit others? Is there a sustainability agenda or any of the other topics I mentioned where they are really trying to dive in deep and demonstrate that they give a darn about what's going on in the world? And so, yes, shareholder maximization and profit are a part of it, but just not the only parts.
So if I'm a shareholder and I care about shareholder value, I care about the value of the stock that I bought. Mm-hmm. I think what you're saying is that I ought to care about other stakeholders as well, because frankly, the company in which I've invested, in which I own the stock, will do better if it pays attention to those other things. So it's still about shareholder value, but you realize as a shareholder, it's got to be more than just the maximization of profits in the short term. You've got to create a culture, an outlook that embraces all consumers, because consumers are spending more time thinking about these other issues that were never really considered before.
That's absolutely right. And in fact, getting ahead of where consumers are going is really important right now. And we're still, in many cases, in a lot of businesses, a little bit behind on that. And that anticipation of where they're going is going to be critical, because obviously businesses are selling whatever they sell to the market. That market is comprised of consumers, and consumers are thinking about these issues now. So getting ahead of that is critical now rather than being behind the times when competitors will certainly catch up to this and realize that this is critical. I mean, look what's happened with BlackRock and Larry Fink's announcements, his last few shareholder letters. They're not perfect, but they've made a statement and put a line in the sand saying, from now on, we're going to look at company climate disclosures. And that's going to be a critical part of our investment strategy. Not alone, TPG has done that. Gary Gensler at the SEC is looking at climate disclosures for the U.S. The EU is ahead of us in some of the regulations in that regard. And so it's happening anyway. And oftentimes you need that regulatory environment to kind of goose businesses along to get up with where consumers are.
So in a weird way, it's a redefinition of capitalism.
Yeah, it really is. And you know, Howard, this has come up before, and I've given talks on this before, and I've had a couple of people on the very cynical end of it, and understandably, but they'll say, well, you really are kind of anti-capitalist. That's not true. I'm as capitalist as they come. I've been in business my whole career. I teach business. I love business. I've written books about it. And I've been exposed to a lot of different ways that people look at business. And there's no question that capitalism has been a great economic value creation machine for the past century, century and a half. We know that. I mean, if you look at the growth of economies worldwide, if you look at the growth of middle classes worldwide, it's been a net positive. However, it's come at a cost. And that cost has been things like environmental degradation. We do have a growing disparity between the haves and the have-nots. And therefore, there's got to be greater attention paid to those issues. And business, just as it's stimulated a lot of success, can also stimulate new innovation to help deliver important new value for these crises that we face.
But aren't these intractable problems that the world faces, aren't they really the purview of governments who should be thinking about it from a policy standpoint, or universities who should be thinking about it from a solution standpoint? Is it really the role of business to solve these problems?
Not by itself. And I think it's actually a really important point that you raise. I'm glad you did this too, because when you look at all of those three societal actors, government, universities, and business, they have to work together, right? There's a collaborative spirit that has to unfold to make this happen. Look, one of the reasons why Silicon Valley, not to look at the larger global issues, but Silicon Valley has blossomed, as we all know, because of that nice intersection of government policy, tax policy, universities, and business wherewithal that's kind of allowed this to unfold. That same kind of energy now needs to apply by bringing these actors together for the benefit of these other societal issues. Governments can have a role in it. Governments can be slow, but to my earlier point, they can create that regulatory structure that encourages business to do the right thing in terms of disclosures. But we also need the research that comes out of universities and the active young minds that are coming out of the latest research to help drive that. And business has an unbelievable amount of potential all the time to innovate further. I mean, we see a lot of innovation in any sector, in any industry, always, right? But business can actually turn that innovation engine even stronger when it's guided by the right regulatory policies, by the right research, to help fuel where we need to go with these changes in order to help reduce the impact on the planet.
So I guess we've seen an extreme example of this actually over the course of the last several weeks. As the war in Ukraine escalates, we've seen corporations all over the world pull out of Russia.
Right.
And it's sort of it's related to what you're talking about, right? Because there are consumers who say, if you want me to be involved with your brand, I want you as a brand to do the right thing. And I think the right thing is no longer to be active in Russia. Ergo, if you don't pull out of Russia, I won't actually spend my money with you any longer.
Correct. And you're right. I mean, if you look at Jeffrey Sonnenfeld, who's the Yale professor at the Yale School of Management, has a daily list that he updates in his research team that tracks the companies that are stopping doing business with Russia. I mean, I think it's over 400 now, it's 300, somewhere in that vicinity, but every day it's updated. And it has obviously grown over the 3 weeks of the war. So absolutely, it's having at least the direction of what business's role is starting to be realized. The actual impact worldwide is still to be seen. We can see how it's cratering the Russian economy, no question about it. But there's downstream impacts long-term, right? I mean, think about the loss of intellectual insight that comes from the lack of exchange that won't be there because of a lack of exchange of ideas between businesses now on. And the Russians will suffer as a result of that. You see it in the world of sports. All the major sports bodies in the world have banned Russian athletes and Russian teams from international competitions because the soft power of both business and sport combined is designed to put some pressure to say, hey, look, there's some real repercussions if you don't stop what you're doing in Ukraine. Now, it's hard to stop a maniacal person, so you don't know whether or not it's going to have an enormous amount of short-term impact, but long-term, it's going to be devastating for Russia.
This is Stanford Pathfinders. I'm Howard Wolf. More with John Davis, the author of Radical Business, on SiriusXM Business Radio Channel 132 in a moment. This is Stanford Pathfinders. I'm Howard Wolf, and I'm speaking with John Davis, author of Radical Business, a book dedicated to the premise that businesses need to do more than simply make a profit. They need to create societal value as well. So we've talked a little bit about the thesis of Radical Business. I want to get into the way that you've organized the book, because I found it fascinating the way that you organized it. By the way, it's a very deep read. I mean, this is it's accessible to the layperson, but it also is something that I think an academic could enjoy as well. You kind of skated right down the edge of that razor blade where it's a popular book, but also something that's meaty enough that someone's really a deeply committed business person could enjoy as well. So you write in the book about corporate aspiration. Those aren't two words that I see together often, corporate aspiration. Yeah. What are the elements of that and why do they matter?
Aspiration is absolutely critical, number one. It isn't something that's make-believe. It came out of the work with different companies that I've done. And aspiration falls within this umbrella of what I call value meaning. And value meaning is really why we're here in the first place. Some of the research in the past that's been done is around purpose. Aspiration is sort of purpose writ large. It means what is ultimately the organization here to do? If you had to say, this is ideal for us, and this is what our reason to exist is in the world, this is our guiding star, that's aspiration. There's actually three different elements that I highlight in the book around aspiration. One of them is this idea of ultimate dream. So what is the ultimate dream of the organization? It's kind of the organization or the company's positive contribution to society. Its implicit cause is probably the best way to frame that. So ultimate dream is part of aspiration. Another part is creating value. Creating value is the explicit expression of that cause, okay? And it's the overt value that any business creates for society, above and beyond profitability and the other things we've talked about. And then the final sort of component of aspiration is the company's character. And character is, I think, understated and underused and underappreciated in a lot of ways, because we always get into that zone of business means business. You know, it's always said emphatically. And yet character is such an important element of what we do as individuals and what companies do as well. And it's your business's moral quality as perceived by people in the marketplace. Back to your point on Russia, those companies that have decided to stop doing business in Russia have a very strong argument about the moral clarity that they are exhibiting to the marketplace. And so ultimate dream, creating value, and company character are three critical elements to defining that aspiration.
Okay, on a related notion, how does corporate culture fit into your radical business mindset? Because I found that chapter to be quite fascinating.
We all know culture is important now. It probably wasn't so important when the structures around business were taught in business schools 50, 60, 70 years ago, because it was termed personnel or human resources, and neither one of those terms is adequate to what it really means for people and organizations. Culture evokes the notion of values and character and the dynamics of the social interaction. And so it's critical, obviously. I mean, that's the bottom line. In fact, much of the work I've done over the past 20 years with leaders and organizations is around that idea of how leaders shape culture and how they can encourage a rich culture internally, right? When we think of culture, we think of countries, language, food, whatnot. But the same is true for a company in a slightly different way, it's a slightly different language. But the bottom line is the same. You've got to have a dynamic organizational fabric, which means the interweaving of the different people inside the organization, their experiences. You've got to have an absolute love of learning or a curiosity mindset. And you've got to have sort of a set of what I call admirable behaviors. And those are things like, think back to when we were in business school, Jack Welch and the GE way or the HP way, right? And those things are still critical. Every company is still trying to define that, but it's around a set of behaviors. What is it that we absolutely stand for and we expect our leaders to demonstrate, right? So those components of a dynamic culture and love of learning and key behaviors really inform company culture. And it's, you know, when I got out of college, the biggest thing in a company was making sure that you separated your professional life from your personal life. The reality of it is it's pretty hard to do. And the research backs that up. You know, social science research by and large says it's pretty hard for us to have an emotional something occur at home and not have that affect us at work. And so the reality of it is a culture is a rich recognition that people come with a wide range of different needs every day to work. And our task as leaders of organizations is to be at least aware of that, have some empathy, and ideally, as Adam Grant of Wharton says, we ought to have some compassion around that too, because that really helps the culture create strong bonds and encourages people to really be inspired and do the right thing.
And the quote that I love most about culture is, of course, the Peter Drucker quote, which goes, culture eats strategy for breakfast. You can have the best strategy in the world, but if your culture's not working, forget that strategy.
Absolutely right.
At the end of the day, this all seems to be about companies creating what you call societal value. Is that your aim, societal value for companies?
It is. And you know, I'm pretty direct about that in parts of the book. I don't do it consistently throughout because it's not necessary throughout. But the theme in there is to say, look, the profit motive is a vestige of an old era. And that era is now gone and it's needs to be replaced by the societal value motive, which means that companies have to do more than just make money off of the widgets they produce.
They still need to make money though, right?
I mean, absolutely. Absolutely. But it gets beyond just the company and what it does day to day and the fact that it employs people. That's all great. Think about the larger aspects of that. The societal value component that's the responsibility of a company are its ecosystem or its value chain, whatever you want to call it. But the partners that are required for a company to not just get the ingredients for the goods, but produce the goods and distribute the goods and whatever the value chain members are also a part of that societal value motive. If your partners in business are, for example, low cost, and that's great for your bottom line, but they also pollute the heck out of the environment, you have to ask the question, is that really a valuable member of our value chain, given what's going on in the world and where consumers are going? So we have to reassess that too, in order to really pay attention to maximizing a new kind of value, which is this societal value.
This world has changed so dramatically. And it seems like over the last 10 years or so, and I know that you investigated a number of companies. Give us a list of companies that you think are doing it right.
Oh, my goodness.
Who's getting it right today?
A lot of the companies are down the path of making some really strong, positive decisions. I'll highlight one that's not in the U.S., for example, and it's called Siam Cement Group, and they're in Thailand. And you might think, a cement company? They've been in business for 100 years, multi-billion dollar firm. They're in the extraction industry, they're in chemicals, and they're trying to make a massive pivot. And that pivot has been underway for some time, last several years. And part of the pivot is to realize that the world's becoming more digital. That's a different kind of aspect of their business model, but they're shifting from heavy intensive investment in extraction towards digital. But the other part of their pivot is recognizing that ultimately as a company, they are more than just something that supports the old style of building industry. They now have to do it more responsibly and sustainably. They have to think about better uses of lighter weight and composite materials, a lower carbon footprint. And they're in the process of doing all these things. So that's one example. It's fascinating to watch because it's hard to take an organization comprised of engineers who have 10-year planning horizons and turn them into 30-day sprint thinking type people, right? But that's what they're in the process of doing. Another organization, which I really love too, and it's a very different kind of organization, is called Norskin, and they're out of Sweden. And Norskin is a foundation founded in 2016 with the explicit intent to help support entrepreneurs who are tackling one of the UN's 17 sustainable development goals. And they have a purpose, if you will, that says, we want to create impact unicorns, not unicorns like Silicon Valley, which is the billion-dollar valuation. They want to create impact unicorns, which are organizations that impact positively a billion lives. Yeah. And they've already helped 39 or 40 different companies and are having impact, particularly in North Africa and Europe. But that type of approach, very different, one's 100 years old, one's 5 years old, 6 years old, doing some really powerful things. And there's a whole list of organizations like that that are having a remarkable impact.
I love that. Instead of having a market cap of $1 billion, you have impact that reaches a billion people. All right, we've got 1 minute left. So here's my question to you. If you could hypnotize the leaders of the top 1,000 companies in the world for 1 minute, what would you tell them to do in that 1 minute?
Love this. Thank you. So because of the conversations I've had with these different leaders, they had sort of a common regret. It wasn't universal, but it was close to it. And that was they wished they had done more to be involved and engaged with the communities they serve. They did well by shareholders. They increased value for the organizations. They were considered heroes in business, but they realized later on that they didn't spend enough time understanding other ways they could more effectively and positively impact those communities. Wherever their operations were, whether it's in country, across countries, that would be what I'd hypnotize them to do. Start now, get going on trying to get your organization thinking about and planning for how to impact societies positively. Because almost to a person, they all said, I didn't do it. I want my successors to do this. We need to build this into our leadership development system in our organization. So that's what I would do.
I only wish I had the ability to help you hypnotize the leaders of the top 1,000 corporations in America. John, thank you so very, very much for being on Stanford Pathfinders.
Oh, Howard, thank you so much as well. Just thanks for giving me the chance. You do great work for exposing the world to all the great ideas coming out of other people.
Thank you for listening to Stanford Pathfinders on SiriusXM Business Radio Channel 132. Listen to this and other episodes anytime, on demand, with the SiriusXM app, or wherever you like to find your podcasts.